Hi guys, we're trying again on StreamYard to see if we can get Peter in to the conversation. We've had some major technical difficulties. I can only apologise on my behalf. I've come in from the shed now into the house to see if we can get Peter involved again. If we can't do it this way, we may have to do it on a pre-recorded interview and get it out to you the best way that we can, through capture software or whatever. I'm just going to invite Peter, or try and invite Peter into this. It may go dark. I do apologise. That is sent to Peter. So hopefully he should be able to come in now, and we might be able to get it up and running again. I can see there are two people in here. I do apologize. People may have to get this on catch up. I work on the premise that anything that can go wrong probably will go wrong, and it's all gone wrong tonight. We managed to get a secure connection this afternoon, but for some reason, Peter was getting a severe lag on his end. We've not been able to use any other sort of streaming device. I'm doing this from a phone, and he's doing it from a computer, so there's... you know, it was always going to be a little bit difficult. We're doing the best we can. I can see that people are now coming in. Comments are enabled, so that's fine. People can make comments. Just allow StreamYard to access your Facebook. Add to stream. Hi Peter, can you hear me? Yeah, right, I can't hear you, so I'm gonna have to plug you in. And hopefully this time it will be better. Can you hear me now? I can't hear you. Have you got the earphones? Hello?
Yep, I can hear you. I can hear you.
It's a little bit crackly. You might need to adjust your... It doesn't seem to want to pick up the microphone.
Can you hear me now?
No.
I can hear you
doing that on it, but...
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, you're breaking up really badly.
Well, we better stack it then, better we, and have another go when you got your tech sorted out.
Yeah, I think we're going to have to
Kerry says that she can hear you. I think it's just a problem between me and you. I don't know why.
Well, I'm afraid this is all proceeding at the pace of a sloth, isn't it, this evening, and not going.
It is, and
well.
I have your voice now. That is better. I can hear you fully.
Right.
I don't know what's happened there, but I can hear you fully. People are saying they can hear you really well.
Okay.
It just, by a miracle, it just seems to have sorted out. I don't know why. I'm not going to question it.
I'm not a man of faith, so I don't believe in miracles, but there you go.
Well, I do.
okay. This is not a theological discussion this evening,
though,
is it? It's
not a theological discussion, no.
Okay.
So we'll start then. A little bit late, so I do apologise, but people seem to have come in. Can you tell me, let's go back to the start, back to your childhood. Can you tell me a bit about your childhood and eventually why you became a policeman?
Well, look, if anybody is still with us at 26 minutes past eight, all I can say is you're far more patient than I am. I've never been a patient sort ever in my life. Even as a kid, I was very impatient, and I still am as an adult. So I commend you all and thank you for sticking with it. I better try and make it worthwhile now, eh? Right, yeah, as a kid, I was largely the product of a one-parent family. My alcoholic and abusive dad cleared off when I was about 10 years old. And at the time, to be perfectly frank with you, it was like good riddance to bad rubbish, because the marriage had been miserable. It had caused a lot of upset and hurt and all of that kind of stuff. And we'd be here all night if I was telling you about tales of how I fell out with my dad and mischief that I got up to by puncturing the tyres on his car and all that stuff. But so it was largely really miserable. And off he went, which was good in one regard, but of course it left my mum, me and my big sister, skint. So my mum worked every hour under the sun to try and put food on the table and clothes on our back, because he just completely buggered off, didn't have any financial input into us kids. And so we had to sell the house. Mum couldn't afford to keep the house. So not long after that, my sister went off to pursue her career in nursing. Big up for the NHS heroes. My big sister is still working in the NHS. She's a sister and she's a hero like so many thousands of the others are. And we all love them, adore them, I hope. And so me and mum, we had a flat a few miles away from where the house was. And, you know, mum had to get up every morning and go to work. And she didn't see me off for school. And so sometimes, stupidly, I didn't go, and it's a matter of regret to this day that I didn't get my head down and get a proper education. Because believe you me, life has not been a gravy train. I might be on the telly and do podcasts and write books and all that kind of stuff, but it's far from a gravy train. And I've had to graft, really, really graft all my life. And I can't help but think that more doors would have been opened and more opportunities might have been available if I'd paid attention and got a bit of an education. Needless to say, I've kind of drummed that into my kids. Unfortunately, all three of them have really picked that up and run with it. My oldest boy left uni some years ago. There's a big gap between him and the two young ones, one of who's now at uni. And my youngest is taking his A-levels next year, and he wants to pursue the uni route, which is, you know, okay, good luck to him. That's what they want to do. So, yeah, flunking my education was a really daft thing to do. And getting involved in petty crime was an even dafter thing to do. Shoplifting, criminal damage, you know, breaking into a garage to nick spray paint so I could go and graffiti QPR all over the place. As you can see by the shirt in the background, I'm still a fanatical season ticket holding QPR fan, although I don't do any graffiti these days and haven't done for many decades. Let me make that again abundantly clear, because you never know who's watching, do you? And drifted, left school at 16, the summer of 1976. Yes, I'm that old, everybody. and it was a glorious summer. Oh, astonishing. So I went fishing. I love fishing. And I was fishing for weeks on end, come home every 3 or 4 days, raid the fridge, have a bath, go back fishing again. And eventually I sort of came home and Mum said, are you going to get a job? So I did. It was easier in those days for a young man to get a job. I got a job as a warehouseman in Woolworths. That's the wonder of Woolworths. That was, and I loved it. But my mum didn't really think, you know, it didn't match her aspirations, shall we say. So one night I got home and to my horror, there was an enormous great copper sitting in the lounge of the flat that I shared with Mum. And my first thoughts were quite, frankly, oh, shit, what am I going to get Nick for? Anyway, he was there to convince this errant 16-year-old that actually joining the old bill might be a decent job. And he did a brilliant job on me. I mean, a really good job. He pitched it properly, you know, the benefits of it, the pitfalls, what it might mean. He was talking about going into the police cadets, not because I'm still only 16. Mm-hmm. And he really sold the idea to me. Sport, discipline, which I shunned most of my life, to be honest with you. But the sport and the opportunities to go climbing mountains and camping out and doing all these kind of things. And before he left, he pulled out the application form and went, boom, there you go. And I filled it out there and then. And a few weeks later, with a haircut, I walked through the gates at Hendon Metropolitan Police Cadet School. And essentially, it kind of transformed my life. I loved the discipline. I threw myself into it. You know, the physical training instructors were ex-Royal Marines, you know, and if you got caught leaning on the wall or if your plimsolls were a bit grubby and all that stuff, and one of the physical training instructors came up to you and went, oi, Blexley, down for 10 press-ups. Or what wasn't an option. The or what would have been unthinkable because these men would have turned you into a crowd in the blink of an eye. Mm. So you did it, and I thrived on it. I fell foul of the discipline. Of course I did. I didn't become an angel overnight, and I got what was called defaulters. So if you got, you know, if you'd done something particularly kind of wrong, you got defaulters, so you couldn't leave the cadet centre. You might have to stay there for the weekends and go on work details, emptying bins and sweeping the parade square and all that stuff. So, of course, I fell foul of that a few times. But I loved it. I loved it. I loved it. And I ended up being a vice house captain in the cadet school, which was remarkable, and I loved it. And 18 months later, when I was 18 and a half, I went up to the other end of the training estate to be sworn in as a police constable. And from a kid that had flunked school, I ended up being top of my class. I won a book prize, which I was, you know, really quite proud of, and I've still got the book up in my loft, safely preserved for one of my grandkids to probably throw out in a few years' time or whatever. Not that I've got any grandkids, but you know what I mean. And I loved it. And then 18 and a half, nearly 19, got posted to Peckham Police Station in southeast London. Now, if I thought I'd been a bit of a Jack the Lad with my shoplifting, my graffiti and my criminal damage, well, when I got to Peckham, I met some proper, proper, tough, hard people and realized just what a suburban bloody fluffy lightweight I was. But of course I had a uniform, so, and I had the law to uphold of a fashion, and I threw myself into it. And coming from the background that I had, I found it pretty easy to nick people, burglars, robbers and car thieves and drug dealers and all that kind of stuff. It wasn't too much of a stretch, and I loved it, and I was half decent at it. I'm talking about the late 70s, early 80s, so there was a lot of very, very bad things going on. The racism was rampant. The fitting up of people was equally as rampant, and that all kind of exploded one weekend in April 1981 with the Brixton riots.
Yeah.
And the UK had never seen rioting like it. Never anything like it. And it transformed my life that weekend, because I suddenly realized what a symbol of oppression I had become because of the uniform that I wore. Mm. And people really wanted to kill me. They literally wanted to kill me that weekend. And all my colleagues, of course, and hundreds of police officers got injured. You know, numerous buildings got burnt down. More cars turned over and set fire to than you can imagine. Dreadful, dreadful weekend. And after that, I went, sod that. I'm not wearing this uniform anymore. I'm going to get out of that, go into plain clothes and try to become a detective.
So what started the Brixton Riots for those people that don't know?
Well, I was on a people carrier at the time. So it's like a transit with windows, green, held about a dozen coppers. We were from Peckham, but we were troubleshooting all round our patch. And our division backed on to Brixton's division. We were neighbouring divisions. So on the Friday afternoon, a shout comes up, urgent assistance, Routon Road. And Routon Road was now known as the front line, predominantly sort of inhabited by Afro-Caribbean, second generation immigrants, some first generation, had a reputation for smoking dope, playing reggae, having little spielers in the basements and all that. And in those days, it was regarded as like being crime of the century. You know, having a legal blues party where you can dance, sell a can of beer and smoke a joint was like crime of the century. And of course, we, jackbooted bloody old Bill, had to smash all these things up, didn't we? And stop it, you know, and keep these people repressed. And in the run-up to this Friday afternoon in April, there'd been Operation Swamp in Brixton, where they had gathered together every cop they could lay their hands on and basically given the instructions to stop and search any black person that moved, essentially. And not surprisingly, tensions built and built and built, and resentment and animosity and a strong dislike of the police. Friday afternoon, young black man gets stabbed. A police officer is laying over this young black man with his knee over the knife wound in his back. Other people, not surprisingly perhaps, think this stab victim is being arrested. Right. And so the tension builds. And it starts off with a bit of mouthing, then it descends into a bit of rock throwing and tension and all of that. So a shout goes up, urgent assistance, Routon Road. Well, there wasn't a dozen of us in our van because it was Friday afternoon and we'd had a very long week and we dropped some of the people off early because Friday in those days in the old Bill was Poets Day. Piss off early, tomorrow's Saturday, right? Poets Day. So there's only about four of us on this van, but we've gone, yeah, boom, urgent assistance. We'll have a lump of that on the radio. Tear up to Routon Road, get out there. Tension's building. There's a bit of a standoff and all that. We try and face them down because that's what the old Bill did in those days. And to kind of cut a long story short, lots of other units turned up. Tensions built. Things started getting thrown. It was really getting nasty. And the senior officers at Brixton Police Station called us all back to the station for a briefing. And they were head scratching and trying to work out what to do with this situation. We were used to try and sort of quelling those situations and putting them down. But this was a bit different. The scale and the size of it, the number of people involved, the number of police officers that had turned up, made it a bit different. Some idiotic senior police officer in Brixton Police Station put us back out on the streets that evening with the sole instruction to just patrol endlessly, endlessly, endlessly in a circle. Not to get out of their vehicles, not to stop anybody, not to search anybody, not to arrest anybody, not to actually do anything other than drive around endlessly in a kind of impotent show of force, you know. And we crept along the streets, you know, just and all we became was a big red rag to a very angry bull. And you could see the tension rising. You could just see it. You know, there was all the hand gestures, the shouting going both ways. We saw people in front of us carrying crate loads of milk bottles, down into basement flats. You didn't have to be Sherlock Holmes to work out what they were going to be becoming. Petrol bombs. Obviously, it was obvious. But were we getting out the van and nicking people for that and stopping that and preventing it? No, 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 no. Once again, with all the pace of a sloth, just patrol around and around and around and essentially irritate the entire local population. Well, the following day, the Saturday, it kicked off wholesale. Literally, you know, more petrol bombs than you've ever seen in mainland UK. Buildings, cars, coppers, you know, over 200 cops got injured. And the Sunday, it was bad, not as bad. And it kind of tailed off on the Sunday. But I didn't go back on the Sunday. But the Saturday was just an absolute, absolute carnage. And could so easily have been avoided. But, you know, it was, policing was a lot clumsier in those days. Some might say it still is, and with some justification. But, yeah, we knew nothing about an Afro-Caribbean, you know, immigrant population or second generation of young black kids growing up. You know, we just had to suppress them, basically. That was kind of the tactic. And, of course, if you do that to people who are underprivileged with chronic social deprivation, lack of opportunity, they're getting fitted up, they're getting beaten up, then what do you expect? They are going to rear up and have a go. And they did. And at the time, Ken Livingston, who later became Mayor of London, was a prominent politician, said that weekend the police got a bloody good hiding. And there was uproar with him saying that. But you know what? From where I was standing, he was bang on.
Yeah. So you went from there. What made you decide to go undercover instead of leaving?
Well, once I bailed out of uniform, I got selected eventually after only a few short months to be a detective. And I went to Kensington in the Royal Borough of Kensington and Chelsea. And it was a rather different area to police. Lots of wealthy people with titles and million-pound houses and all this kind of stuff. There was an area on our patch of social deprivation, but I'd never seen an area like Kensington High Street. Kensington High Street was one of the places to go to and shop if you were loaded. Harrods was just down the road, just off our patch. And it was a very, very different place. So I got exposed to lots of different crime and I investigated lots of different crime, which was great because my knowledge base was increasing and I was becoming a vastly more experienced detective across a wider range of crimes. There was also murder and rape and other hideous things, but I threw myself into those and dealt with those kind of crimes as well. And after 3.5 really enjoyable years at Kensington of working very hard and playing very hard, the next natural progression for me was to become a Scotland Yard detective. That was my ambition. I was fortunate enough to be approached by a couple of squads and I decided to go for the Central Drug Squad because at the time, Ronald Reagan was banging on about the war on drugs. He wasn't the first president to do that. That had been Richard Nixon back in 1971. Ronald Reagan's wife, Nancy, was launching her Just Say No campaign. Well, what a resounding success that has been over the decades, eh? And I thought, well, I'd witnessed it at Kensington. The explosion of cocaine onto our streets was really, really gathering pace. And many other drugs. And I thought, no, the drug squad at the yard is where the focus is going to be, the resources are going to be. And I plumped for that. And not long after I'd been there, I saw and learnt how people were doing undercover operations up there. And I thought, yeah, I reckon I could do that gig. So when the first opportunity for an undercover job cropped up and the old detective inspector swaggered down to the end of the office and he went, "We've got an undercover job coming. Anybody want to do it?" Well, like a 5-year-old at primary school who's got the answer to the teacher's question, my arm shot up and I'm like, yeah, I'll have a go. And so began a quite frankly bonkers 10 years of me working undercover.
Well, so was it primarily drugs you were undercover on, or?
Yeah, the majority, but not all, by a long chalk. Drugs, guns, counterfeit currency. I mean, I bought millions of pounds worth of counterfeit dollars, for example, and other currencies. High-value stolen goods, antiques. I mean, I could never profess to be an expert in antiques, but horses for courses. And if one particular... I remember on one occasion, I bought a tile that had been stolen from a museum. It was thousands of years old, and it was worth an absolute fortune. And somehow I managed to carry it off. I pretended to be the middleman, you know what I mean? I didn't pretend to be the expert in ancient Greek antiquities, because that wouldn't really have worked for me. But yeah, I managed to buy this tile, and the museum, and universities were delighted to get it back and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, so drugs, guns, yeah, by the bucket load. High value stolen goods, counterfeit goods. And from time to time, I'd profess to be an undercover killer, you know, gun for hire, trained assassin. If somebody wanted their business partner or their love rival or something like that murdered, then I'd step forward and carry out the negotiations for that, which invariably would end up with them being charged with conspiracy to murder.
So was it hard to step into that sort of role, or I suppose it's acting really, isn't it? But was it hard to keep your nerves down and just plow on through?
I was an oiky South London kid. So, you know, the role that I always portrayed wasn't that much different from what I'd been, you know, and the bloke I am. You know, the easiest lie to tell is the one that's closest to the truth. It's when you start leaping off at a frigging tangent and trying to pretend you're an helicopter pilot or a bow-tied expert in fine art or something, you're going to get caught out. The best lies are the ones that are closest to the truth. And so I've always been a bit of a South London sort of bloke, and that by and large was the character that I professed to be. And just so I didn't have to stretch the lies too far.
So what's your most memorable case, if you can talk about it?
Well, there's many, many, many of them. In my autobiography called The Gangbuster, which I will unashamedly plug. It's available on Amazon and all that. It's been out for about 18, 19 years now, and it still sells, The Gangbuster. Virtually all the memorable tales are in there. The most memorable one, of course, is the one that had catastrophic consequences for me. And that was when myself and a undercover colleague from Customs and Excise were negotiating with a proper bunch of crooks who were linked to and believed to be funded by terrorists. And they were supplying us with vast quantities of heroin. In fact, when the consignment of heroin got delivered to me in a hotel room at Gatwick Airport, at that time, it was the largest quantity of heroin that had ever been seized on the mainland. Not at ports, but, you know, on the mainland. I spent hours weighing it and testing it, you know, with a bad guy in a hotel room. After all that was done, and I had a banging headache from burning so much heroin on foil and all that stuff. Me and him go to the bar to have a celebratory drink to the start of a wonderful and lucrative business arrangement. Armed police come out of nowhere, throw us to the ground, nick us. Simultaneous arrests are made around the country where money was going to be handed over and all that kind of stuff. And when all the bad guys appeared in court a couple of days later, they look around in the dock and they're going, well, where's that ponytailed, cocky South Londoner? Because I wasn't in the dock with them. So, of course, you didn't have to struggle too hard to work out that I must have been an undercover cop. And they worked on the theory that if they kill me, they kill the evidence, which was, you know, not was bang on, to be perfectly honest with you. But, the plot to kill me was discovered by the FBI, who had a phone tap on a bar in Boston, Massachusetts. And they heard about them trying to find this undercover cop called Peter, and the assassin was going to be called the Doctor, and the weapon was called the Doctor's Bag. Not the most imaginative code words ever, but and the assassin was going to come over to the UK. They were going to try and find me and kill me. Well, they'd have had a struggle trying to find me, because all they had, you know, was they'd seen me and all of that. But of course, we took some kind of steps to make sure that we were careful. But then what happened was a report about that that whole operation, which was multi-agency. It involved customs, police, the Drug Enforcement Agency in America, the FBI, the Garda Síochána in Ireland, and other law enforcement agencies. It's been very complex, and there have been lots of fighting over territory and infighting, all at the senior rank level, you know, like above me. I'm just, you know, I'm out there at the coalface doing the graft. But the deputy commissioner wanted a document, a report written about it all, which a detective sergeant on the investigating team did. But in that report, instead of putting my code number, which is allocated to me by the undercover unit at the yard and used to be 522, instead of putting that code number in the report, this person that I will politely call a man put my real name, my full name, Detective Constable Peter Blexley. Well, I've got a very unusual surname with a very unusual spelling, Blexley. I think there's only about 14 Blexleys in the UK, and I've fathered most of them. only three of them, I'm joking. You know, and for some inexplicable reason, my real name went in that report and featured on every page virtually. So that's the first big ricket. The second thing that shouldn't have happened was that report was printed out and taken out of the police building in a briefcase in a covert car, in an undercover police car. And then the same officer that wrote the report printed it off, took it out of the police station in a briefcase in the back of the car, parks that car up and goes shopping. Shopping, would you believe? Or so the story went. And guess what happens while he's shopping? Oh, yes. That car gets broken into. And, of course, the briefcase containing the report, which contains my real name, gets stolen. So now, if the bad guys that want to kill me can then marry up that plot and my name, shit just got real, so to speak. And literally one night I'm driving home from work, get a phone call, don't go home. What? From one of the bosses at the yard, at Scotland Yard. Don't go home. Right, are you going to tell me why I can't go home? No. Take one of your false identities, move into a hotel, and get to the yard at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. Right. Okay. So my girlfriend, told me to get my girlfriend to pack an overnight bag and meet me at the hotel, which she did. So she's sitting there in the hotel room with me, and she's going, "What's all this about?" I said, "I don't know. No idea. Something's obviously gone seriously wrong. But I quite frankly don't know. You might not be surprised to hear that I caned the minibar in the hotel room that night as I sat there trying to think what on earth it could be about. Didn't get to the yard at 9 o'clock the following morning. Of course not, got there at 8, didn't I? And a mate of mine said, "Have you seen this?" as he pulled the report out of his pocket. And I said, "No." He said, "Right, there's a copy for you. Stick that in your pocket because I think you're going to need that. And here's another copy," locks me in a little side office. He said, "Read that." Well, I couldn't believe what I was reading. You know, there's my name on page after page after page. And I've still got a copy of it on my bookshelves behind me. And by the time close of play that very day, the bosses at Scotland Yard had decided that I had to leave my flat, abandon my identity, and be parachuted into the witness protection program. And so began the most miserable 2 years of my life.
That must have been like, no matter how strong you are as a person, getting ripped away from everything that you know, and put into a witness relocation and put into that situation, it must have been bonkers. It must have been like soul destroying for you.
Well, it was nonsense and it was horrible. It was nonsense because, believe it or not, Scotland Yard still wanted me to work undercover. So this is how a typical day would go. I'd wake up in the morning and I wasn't in a home. I was in a hideout, right? As much as, you know, they gave it a lick of paint and all that, it was not a home. It was purely and simply a hideout. So I come downstairs, pick up the mail on the doormat, and that is addressed to the false identity that I'm living in witness protection, right? So that's the first person I've been that day, right?
Right.
I get ready, go to work, get in a car. First of all, I've checked underneath it to make sure no bastards put a bomb there, right? Goodness knows what the neighbours thought. Get in the car, drive to work, and for about an hour, I can be myself. Turn the radio on, put whatever music on I want. And for that hour, I'm myself. So that's the second person I am during that day. Then I get to work, walk into the office, and one of the governors will go, "Blex, got another undercover job coming today. Fancy it?" What am I going to say? So by 11:30 in the morning, or midday, for example, I would have been three people in one day. And it was just unsustainable. You know, by the time I finished work anyway, whatever time of day or night that might be, and I go home to the hideout, what am I going to do? You know, I live in continual fear of the assassin's bullet. I'm still convinced that there's been some great big conspiratorial nonsense going on regarding the report and all of that. And my mental health is falling apart and I'm drinking like a fish. I mean, the bloke who ran the local off license loved me because he saw me every day, every other day, with another big drink to go home and try and blot it all out and lose it and all that kind of stuff. So it was catastrophic. It was absolutely catastrophic. And it's not surprising that I ended up having a major mental health breakdown and being admitted to a lock-in psychiatric ward.
Yeah, I would imagine that was... I've had some experience with running like short and long cons back in the day with a few crews out in Leeds. And I know how difficult it can be keeping a persona, but keeping three personas in your head and then pushing yourself and pushing yourself. I mean, I've struggled with mental health, but that must have really caused an identity crisis.
Yeah, it was a disaster waiting to happen. Unfortunately, in those days, you know, mental health just wasn't a consideration. Not when you're a roughy, toughy Scotland Yard detective. None of my bosses were aware of it. None of them gave it a thought. And when I finally became as seriously, seriously ill as I was, it was only then really that they sort of begrudgingly took some notice.
So you went into you went into a psychiatric hospital. When you got out, what was your next step?
Well, 3.5 weeks later, after they'd found some meds that worked for me, I was released from that ward. But I hadn't been fixed. I was better. I was a lot better, but I wasn't really kind of fixed. But the police, once again, in their infinite wisdom, thought it would be okay for me to go to university and do a psychology degree. I was frigging really ill. I mean, it was all just a bit of a joke, really. Nobody knew how to handle me or how to handle the situation. I clung on to my job. I got better. and better bit by bit. Went back to work, obviously never to work undercover again, but I did a bit of surveillance and, you know, some office-based intelligence work. But then eventually I'd been at the yard or on yard squads for about, oh, goodness knows how long, and they put me back to a police station, and that was just a catastrophe. My reputation preceded me. I felt very, very stigmatized because of my mental health issues and all of that. And I found myself driving out of the police station yard one day in my car, and I'm gripping the steering wheel so tight that the whites of my knuckles are almost blinding me. And I said to myself, this is enough. This is enough now. I'm gonna become ill again. So I drove home, and I went, that's it. I'm not going back. And I wasn't well. You know, I just wasn't fully recovered. It was clearly impacting on me again. And a few months later, I was medically retired from the old Bill. So there I was, 39, 40 years old, no education to fall back on, no trade, no craft, no former calling, nothing to fall back on. 40 years old on the scrap heap of life. What am I going to do?
So what did you do?
Well, I had the hump still about the way I'd been treated by the old Bill. I wasn't, you know, I wasn't particularly happy about all of that. I felt I had a story to tell, a good story, an entertaining story, you know, a story that people would enjoy and would like, you know, because by crikey, I'd done some things during my time in the old Bill. 21 years in the old Bill, I had done some things, particularly seeing as that over 10 of those years had been undercover. I was fortunate and I got a publishing deal for my autobiography. I had some help with that from an experienced writer. And that kind of threw me when that came out. I think it was first published in 2001. And as I say, it still sells a few to gangbuster. People contact me and really still enjoy it, which is lovely. That threw me into the media. All of a sudden, from living a very, very secretive life, my name was in the public domain. TV stations, news channels, radio are ringing me up to talk about crime and policing. And then I got a story consultancy gig on a BBC One drama. And that was kind of, okay, I guess I'm sort of in the media now.
Yeah. So you're doing the consultancy. Did you then go into, was it that you then you went into becoming a private investigator? I do apologize. We seem to have lost Peter. Let's try and get him back in the stream. I do apologise about this. We're going all right. And now we've lost him. Let's try and get him back. I'm hoping Peter will come back. Might go black again for a second. Bam, bam, bam. Trying to get Peter back. It hasn't been great tonight. We've managed to have him for a little while. But we seem to have lost him. Excuse me. Hopefully we can get him back. Bum, bum, bum. It seems we've lost him. We were having a really good conversation, it was going really well, and then I am going to do apologize about this, guys. I'm doing my best to get him back. I can see there are 7 people in here. Say hello if you're still in here. We've got Blexley back. Let's see if we can get back in the stream. There we go. Hopefully. There we go. Hi, Peter.
All right.
Yeah, we're back.
Okay.
We lost from the stream for some reason. How is your how's your microphone? Is that working okay now again?
I can hear you loud and clear.
Yeah, up and down again. Let's try this again.
Right. So if we can try and get back to, so you're on. That's better, mate. I've got you now. So where were you? You were.
I don't know. You tell me. Where was I? I've forgotten.
You were in the media.
Yeah. So I'm in the media. Yeah. So that, and you know, one way or another, I've sort of scratched a living there. I mean, I became really fascinated about unsolved murders because whilst I didn't work on a lot of murders when I was in the old bill, I never worked on an unsolved one. And suddenly, because I'd moved away from murders and spent so much time on serious and organised crime, you know, it's kind of by now it's like 2002, 2003, and I'm becoming fascinated and irritated by the fact that people can commit murder in the 21st century with detectives having all the tools available to them that they've now got in the modern era, and yet people are still committing murder and getting away with it. So my second and third books, second book called On the Run, third book called To Catch a Killer, were about unsolved murders, because I was and still am fascinated and massively, massively irritated that people can commit murder and get away with it. Because I believe that the fundamental rule that binds all of society together says we don't kill each other. Because if we do, where are we going to be? You know, where are we going to be at? What kind of vigilante sort of nightmarish world will we live in? And yeah, and that's fascinated me and still has. Which largely brings me around to my current project, which I'll talk about in just a minute. Finding Mr. Kevin Pahl. Yeah, so, you know, I've done hundreds, probably thousands of broadcasts on radio and television about policing and crime and other things as well. I did 6 series of Hunted and Celebrity Hunted for Channel 4, which was a lot of fun. Met some wonderful people and a great experience. But I took it as far as I could go, because in the last series that I was a part of, that I was the chief of, we caught all of them. None of them got their grubby hands on the 100 grand, which was lovely. That had always been our aim, our stated ambition, to catch them all. And when we did, it was lovely. Many members of the public went absolutely garrity about it and didn't like it. And you got all the nonsense. Fix. Yeah, righto. Go and do one. People who know nothing about how investigations work and all of that. But it was great. We had a terrific night that night. A really, really unforgettable night. Cost me an absolute bloody fortune. Because as a chief, I felt it was my duty to stick my credit card behind the bar for a while.
Yeah.
Oh, my word. Don't tell the wife, ever. Needless to say, because, you know, we caned it for a bit. But anyway, yeah, it was great. And left the show February 2019. And I was thinking, right, what am I going to do as my next major project? My publisher said, yeah, you can have another book deal if you've got the right subject material. And I thought, well, you know, despite, because I'd also written plays for Radio 4. I've written 3 plays for Radio 4. I'd written 3 books. But the bottom line was I was best known for catching pretend fugitives on a bloody TV entertainment show. So I thought, right, combine all of that together, my experience, my contacts, you know, my network, what I'm known for. So instead of hunting pretend fugitives, with my passion about unsolved murders,
yeah,
let's go and hunt a real one. And believe you me, they do not come more wanted than 6'6", Liverpudlian, 40-year-old Kevin Pahl, P-A-R-L-E, Kevin Pahl. And he's wanted in connection with 2 separate murders. There's the victims on the back. 16-year-old, yes, 16 years old, a kid, a child, Liam Kelly, wanted for the blasting to death with a shotgun of Liam Kelly, and 22-year-old mother of 3 young children, Lucy Hargreaves, who, if you'll excuse me, I think I'm going to sneeze. Lucy Hargreaves described to me by those who knew her as being as beautiful on the inside as she was on the outside. A mother of 3 young kids who have had to grow up without their mum, knowing that she was blasted to death with a shotgun and that nobody has ever been held accountable for that ghastly crime. 2 despicable ghastly crimes. And what do we want? You know, do we want the Shotgun to sing the song in Liverpool? Or do we want Lennon McCartney, Ian Prowse, Jerry and the Pacemakers? You know, who what do we want? Kevin Powell simply must be found. And so for the last 18 months, I've been hunting him. He's not convicted of either of these crimes. Let me make that abundantly clear. But he is very much wanted in connection with both of them. And I've devoted the last 18, nearly 19 months of my life to finding him. And it dominates my life, morning, noon, and night. I've had a remarkable journey. I am still on a quite remarkable journey. Fortunately, the BBC came on board. And we have, at the moment, 12 parts of a podcast out there. I don't know if you can see that.
Yeah.
Manhunt, Finding Kevin Powell. It's our podcast about my ongoing hunt. Further episodes of the podcast have been commissioned by the BBC. And as soon as we can make more information public, we will do. But our podcast has won an award at the prestigious New York Radio Festival Awards. It's been downloaded over 2.5 million times. So it's rather popular. Please have a listen to it. I'm sure you'll enjoy it. And 2 months ago, to my book, my latest book, which is also called Manhunt, was published, which is about my hunt for Kevin Powell. It's very different from the podcast, very different. And many people have kindly done reviews of both, and they've said, you know, I listened to the podcast, thought, what's the book going to give me? Read the book and realized just how different it was. And people have said astonishingly nice things about the book. And if you go to theworks.co.uk, believe it or not, it is only £4.
I will link it.
Please do. Christmas is coming. I'm just flattered by the lovely things that everybody said about it. Kevin Powell will be found. Yeah, Kevin Powell must be found, and Kevin Powell will be found.
So who is Kevin Powell? What can you tell me about Kevin Powell?
40 years old, didn't come from the rough side of the street in Liverpool at all. He's not from Croxteth, Toxteth, Highton, Norwich Green, not from any of those places. Came from the south of the city. Pretty sort of middle-class kind of upbringing, really. Went to a private school. Big lump, like his brothers, 6'6". But essentially, he was a bit of a wannabe for some reason. Started a degree course, which he never finished, and was just, for whatever reason, was a wannabe. The big cheeses in the Liverpool crime world didn't trust him to start with. He was given kids to look after, basically, and to run, which may or may not be why, you know, young Liam met such a premature and ghastly death. Was Kevin Powell trying to prove something? Prove himself? Take a step up? Join the big boys? I mean, he won't like it, and quite frankly, I don't give a toss. But I've met people that knew him when he was a kid. We go back as far as his primary school and as a teenager. And people describe him as a clown. You know, a little shit, somebody else described him as. A designated driver, somebody described him as. So he wasn't, you know, born to be a tough nut, born to run with the first division kind of outfit, but clearly wanted to make a name for himself. He's very smart. Very smart. Many people have told me how intelligent he is and how smart he is. And that would be borne out by the fact that he's been on the run for over 16 years and not been caught. So clearly he is smart, and he's proven to be a very worthy adversary. And he might always be too clever for me and too smart. And I might never find him, but I ain't never given up.
No. I will say my wife's just linked the book in the comments. So you should be able to just click on that and get in there. What's the closest that you got to Kevin Powell?
Well, when I started my hunt for him, there was quite a few people decided to troll me and abuse me, saying he was dead. To which I would say, prove it. Where's the evidence? And they'd say, you need a deep sea diving suit. He's in the bottom of the Mersey, or he was chopped into bits and thrown overboard in the Mediterranean and all that. It's nonsense. If you listen to the podcast and you read the book, you will find ample evidence of the fact that he is alive, without a doubt, which is fine and inspiring, because clearly, you know, I would rather find him alive than discover evidence of his death. But if I do that, then so be it. That would still afford some kind of closure for the victims, because this is all about Liam and Lucy. Yeah. It ain't about Kevin Powell and it ain't about me. This is about Liam and Lucy, 16 and 22 years old. Please don't lose sight of that fact. We've traveled to many different places, and there are still many, many more doors I've got to knock on and people I've got to see. Some wonderfully courageous people have come forward and continue to come forward and give me evidence about Powell, those that are harboring him and funding him. This ain't going to be easy. It hasn't been easy. It's been arguably the greatest work challenge of my life. But that's what will make it all the more satisfying when law enforcement slapped the handcuffs on him.
So what's the story I hear about you were in Spain and you were in a bar handing out flyers? Is that right?
Yeah. We've been to many bars handing out flyers. We went to a cannabis club in Spain, or they're called cannabis associations sometimes. And these basically are places that have cropped up all over Spain, where if you show some photo ID and proof of residence, pay a membership fee, you can go into one of these places and just sit there and smoke to your heart's content. You can't buy gear in there and you can't serve gear up in there. They're kind of strictly monitored in that regard. And the old bill is supposed to be quite hot and they'll close you down if they get a whiff of that. But if you just want to go, if you're a stoner, obviously pre-COVID, clearly, and it will be post-COVID. But if you want to go and get stoned with like-minded people, then you can go to these places. Well, back in February, we were in Spain. Me and my mate Mark, who's my podcast editor. And we've been told that Paul frequented one of these cannabis clubs, cannabis associations. And we've been given directions for it. It's between a cocktail bar and a gym. And we're looking, we're going up and down the road looking for this. And I could see a place that looked a bit like a doctor's surgery or a dentist kind of place, you know, quite kind of sterile and white with frosted glass that I thought, you know, you could probably see out, but I can't see in. And to me, that didn't fit with my obviously incorrect and preconceived notion of what a cannabis club might look like. I thought it might be a bit bohemian, a bit basement and what have you. Anyway, Mark and I are standing there, and Mark's got his microphone because he's always hoovering up audio for the podcast. And he's saying to me, you know, so what do you think? Blah, blah, blah. And I'm just about to talk to him. And out of the door comes two young fellas, Mediterranean kind of complexion, dark hair. And I said, yeah, can we help you? I said, yeah. Is this, you know, the cannabis club, blah, blah, blah. And I said, I mean, this is something that I'm still kicking myself for, like hugely. They said, I'm looking for a guy called Kevin. And one of them went, oh, tall Kevin. Yeah, not half, yeah, like 6'6" Kevin, I'm thinking to myself. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, tall Kevin, English guy. Yeah, that's it. Yeah. And I say, oh, well, what do you want to talk to him for? And this is where I made an enormous, great ricket. Because what I did was I delved into my rucksack, which I've always got, and of course pulled out one of these. And as you can see, they are obviously developed from a mugshot, aren't they? And straight away, the geezer went, no, 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 oh, no, 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 no. He said, no, he said, the Kevin that we're talking about is 75 years old. Yeah, righto. So how many tall 75-year-old white English Kevins are there living in a small town called Albia on the outskirts of Benidorm? Yeah, really? No. They were talking about Kevin Parr, obviously. Yeah. And I've had it listened to by experts, you know, the country's leading criminologist. And, you know, very vastly experienced people. And then they've all gone, yeah, they're lying, of course. They're talking about Kevin Parr. So, you know, it's just another example of how we've proved that he's alive. And we don't know how recently you've been there, because clearly those blokes were on his side and weren't going to tell me. But it's all great. You know, this is what inspires me to keep going, you know, because he's alive. Yeah. He's out there. And whether he's gone from there to Dubai, to Thailand, wherever he may have gone, to Ireland, back to the UK, you know, as long as I'm drawing breath, I'm looking for him.
Yeah.
End of story. As long as I can put one foot in front of the other, as long as I can bash this keyboard, I'm looking for him. End of.
So I can, you kind of said about the young man, but where does the young woman come into it? Why would he take the life of a young woman?
Well, Lucy had the great misfortune. Let me be careful how I word this. Lucy's partner was a guy called Gary Campbell. Lucy was murdered in August of 2005. In 1993, 12 years earlier, Gary Campbell was allegedly the passenger in a stolen car that hit a group of pedestrians and killed a four-year-old boy.
Right.
Two men stood trial for Lucy's murder and they were acquitted. But the court was told that the attack on Lucy's home was a revenge attack whereby they were trying to take the life of Gary Campbell, who was upstairs with their two-year-old kid. Not only did they shoot Lucy, they set fire to the house afterwards. And so Gary Campbell and his two-year-old daughter had to escape the inferno by leaping out of a first-floor window. These were not professional assassins. They were hideous, vile, pathetic amateurs.
That is just absolutely harrowing. I must say that's painful to listen to. That stunned me, honestly, to be honest.
It's a vile, vile, ghastly crime. And do you know what? Fair play. Many people in Liverpool that I've spoken to, I've spent weeks and weeks and weeks up in Liverpool, and I can't wait to get back up there as soon as travel restrictions allow. Many people in Liverpool have said to me, Peter, look, you know, you're born and raised in this city with the attitude that you don't grass, you don't talk to the authorities, you certainly don't tell the police what you know. And I go, okay, yeah, fine, I get that, you know, and I have to respect that if that's what people want to say. But Lucy's murder is a completely different ballgame. Completely different. Hardened career criminals in Liverpool go, that's wrong. That is just so, so wrong. She was a beautiful, entirely innocent and unconnected to any kind of crime, lovely young lady. Blasted to death with a shotgun and then set on fire. You amateurish, filthy, revolting people. Kevin Parr is wanted in connection with that crime, and I, of course, want to find him.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see why. You know, one of my questions was going to be why Kevin Parr, but that is just, I can understand.
Yeah, and let's not forget, Liam was a 16-year-old kid, yeah. Right? I was a pain in the ass when I was a 16-year-old kid. Liam was denied the opportunity to grow, to mature, to enter manhood, to find a partner, to have some kids and to provide for them. He was denied all of that. He was a child. Kevin Pahl is wanted in connection with the murder of a child and a 22-year-old mother of three young children. They don't come any more wanted than Kevin Pahl, in my opinion.
No. No. So you're pushing through this. I presume you're doing every sort of bit of media that you can to get Kevin Powell's story across. Because until I'd seen the remnants of the podcast and heard you speaking about Kevin Pahl, I knew nothing about it. Yeah, I'm a 43-year-old man, so, you know, what was it, like 16 years ago, you know, I would have been still accomplishmentist and that, you know, I must admit, I hadn't heard of it.
Tonight is a victory for me, Jack, because you now know about Liam and Lucy and the fact that Kevin Pahl is wanted, and your listeners, your viewers, now know about Liam and Lucy and Kevin Pahl. So tonight's a great night for me because it's a victory, because so much of what I'm doing is geared up to spreading the word. Because by spreading the word about Liam and Lucy, and of course the fact that Kevin Pahl is wanted in connection with both of those crimes, this is how we will shrink the world for him. Mm. Bit by bit, I'm shrinking the world. And eventually, I'm going to squeeze the planet so tightly that his 6'6" nut is going to pop up and law enforcement can slap the handcuffs on.
Yeah.
And then he can be put in front of a court to answer the allegations that are made against him. That's justice. Whatever is the outcome of those court cases is nothing to do with me, because I'm not investigating the murders. I am merely trying to find Kevin Pahl. And find him, I will.
That's certainly commendable. And, you know, like you say, it takes up a lot of your time. Do you find that difficult in balancing it with your family? I found sometimes when I get immersed into my work, when I was doing the book about people escaping human trafficking, I got immersed into their stories and into their world. And I know you've been immersed into different identities. Do you find it hard in separating that from your family? Or is it just totally just overtaking your life and your family? I'm lucky to have an understanding wife. You know, are you the same?
I love work. I absolutely love work. It's what keeps me young, you know. I've got the energy and enthusiasm for work that I had when I was half my age, and I love it. And I can't ever see myself stopping work, because I absolutely love it. I've got an understanding family. Yeah, we try and have dinner together every night time, sit around the table. How are you? What have you done today? What's going on in your life? All that kind of stuff. We definitely try and make time for that. But a lot of the time I'm on the road, you know, and my family understand that. Yeah, I try and sit down and sit in front of the TV and watch a bit of TV with them and watch sport and all of that. But hunting Kevin Pahl does hoover up an enormous amount of my time. And my family know that. They're aware of it. They probably think, as long as I'm doing that, it'll keep me out of trouble. And consequently, I'm very lucky in that they support me. And of course, you know, you try and set an example to your kids, don't you, to work hard and, you know, try and set yourself goals and see if you can achieve them.
Yeah. Yeah. So what's next for you after this?
Can't even begin to think. After COVID, knocking on doors and getting in front of people in my ongoing hunt for Kevin Pahl. You know, that's it. I do other bits of work when they crop up, because hunting Kevin Pahl is a very expensive thing to do.
Yeah.
So I need to do other bits of work to put some money in the pot. So if a day's work on TV crops up here, or a bit of commentary on crime pops up there, you know, I can cop a little payment and it all goes into the Kevin Pyle hunt. My wife would also like me to put some money on the, you know, on the dinner table, but they kind of understand. So I do other work from time to time. I was very lucky. Last year, I presented a TV series on a channel called CBS Reality. The series was called New Scotland Yard Files. But in essence, it was only about 12 days work,
right?
You know, in total to do the 10 episodes. You know, and that bit of money, those 12 days work, you know, was great because, you know, I can give, you know, say a bit of that money's for the family. But, you know, the other money is goes in the old hunting Kevin Pyle pot. But, yeah, it's relentless. But you know, it would be so worthwhile, you know, so that at the end of the day, perhaps Leo and Lucy's family will have some degree of closure. You never get over it. I've spent more time than I care to mention in the company of people who have lost children to murder. And of course, the pain never goes away. They just learn to live with it. And one of those people in particular is a lady called Tracy Hansen, whose 21-year-old son Josh got brutally murdered by a piece of garbage called Shane O'Brien, who went on the run, funnily enough, for 3.5 years. And Tracy's a mate of mine, and she, you know, she ain't ever going to get over it, but she deals with it. And she's inspired, and she's the most uplifting, inspiring woman I've ever met. I absolutely adore her. And I know the hurt that gets caused, and I've spent time with other people who have lost their kids to murder. So it's just got to be found. This is about truth over lies. This is about right over wrong. This is about justice. And there's no halfway house for me here now. Yeah. You know, you are either on the side of honesty, truth, and justice because you want to see Kevin Pyle caught. If you can afford £4 for the book, please buy it, read it, and hand it on to someone. Help spread the word. Have a listen to the podcast, Manhunt, Finding Kevin Pyle. It's on the BBC Sounds platform and other places. Please have a listen, read the book. Buy it if you can afford it. I know it's difficult financial times for many people, but you can get it for £4 out there. Spread the word. There's no halfway house here for me. No. You're either on the side of Pyle and his associates, in which case I'm coming for you, and I'm going to find out what you're doing and who you are, and you'll only have yourselves to blame if you get nicked in regards to harbouring him, funding him, or other criminality. Don't blame me. You'll only have yourselves to blame. I've put out an offer to them on many an occasion. I can hand him over, or I'll just keep carrying on finding out and finding out and finding out. Or you're on the side of honesty, truthfulness, righteousness, and wanting to see Kevin Pyle caught. There's no middle ground. There's none of this, oh, I don't want to get involved. Not my business, as far as I'm concerned. Because I do see things sometimes in a rather binary way. So, you know, that's it. You're either on board the hunt for Kevin Pyle, or you're on his side, in which case.
I can say wholeheartedly that I've lost friends and I've lost family to murder. And when someone is taken from you like that, it takes away a piece of your soul, takes away a piece of your heart. And, you know, you can try, but you will never be the same again. You'll never function the same again. You'll never think the same again. What you have said tonight has really affected me, and I want to do whatever I can to help you get the word out. I know that my followers will do the same. We'll post your books. We'll post anything that we can to put Pyle's face out there. Because I didn't think it was going to affect me like this. It really has sort of shocked me, you know, knowing that two people so young, that their lives have gone, and knowing from a family's point of view how it feels. And it's just, I can see why you're pushing forward. I can see why you're doing it. I will give you all the support I can, personally.
Thank you, Jack. Thank you. But, you know, as you know and I know, we've both had mental health issues. So I don't want to impact adversely upon you. And I need to ask this now. Are you okay? I mean, are you okay?
I'm fine. I have a network of people that I work with. I'm a very blessed man in the fact that I have a very understanding family. I have a very understanding wife. I have a very understanding best friend, who is on the comments now. And I have a church behind me. I have a faith that I utilize. You know, I'm clean and sober. I have been for coming up to 6.5 years. And I have a sense of justice. I wasn't always from the right side of the fence. I was a hapless, hopeless, homeless, drug addicted loser. I've been violent in my lifetime. I've done some things that have affected people. I've hurt people beyond belief. And that, you know, while I can try and make amends, I may never be able to make amends to all them people. I work a 12-step program. I'm comfortable with that. I'm comfortable with the way I am. I know that not everybody's going to see me for the person that I was reborn into. I know there are people out there that are going to think a leopard can't change his spots. There are people out there that are always going to keep me under that scrutiny. But at the end of the day, I've got a whole community where I live that keep an eye out for me. I've got a wife that I love very dearly, and it's my first wedding anniversary next week. I've got children whom I love, and so yeah, I'm fine. I have my down days. We all have our down days. It's never easy every day, all day, but we get through it. And part of the way that I do that is to be a voice for other people, to offer a sounding block, a platform for people to be able to get their stories across. It's why I became an accidental journalist. It's why I told the stories of the escapees of human trafficking, which really did sort of change my life. And now I just want to speak for those that can't speak, and the ones that have been murdered can't.
Very, very commendable, Jack. But will you please send me a message tomorrow morning,
yep,
after you've slept on it, just in case what you've heard tonight impacts negatively upon you?
Yep,
I'm always here. Likewise, you can always talk to me, right? So please drop me a line tomorrow. If there's been any impact, we can talk it through together, perhaps. Or I'm so glad for you that you've got a wonderful network of wife, friend, church, believers, all of that. Not a man of faith myself, as you know, but utterly respect anyone who believes. I think that's wonderful. I think that's the basis of a tolerant society, isn't it? That we can all have our own feelings and thoughts, and respect and embrace and all of that. And I've been to many, many places of worship, and by crikey, some of the most astonishing buildings I've ever seen or been into in my life. So I'm so happy for you, Jack. I'm a firm believer in second chances. You know, I completely believe in that. There are some people that are beyond the pale, but they're small in number. But essentially, I've been so lucky. I've been given more second chances than I probably deserve. And I guess in that regard, you and I have some striking similarities.
Yeah, it's I'm just really sort of blessed to have some very supportive fans as well. I have some people in my life that have followed me, followed my career from the start, that have really been sort of a help. Jason Edwards is one of them. He did the first lockdown legacy. He's a hostage negotiator. He's been really pivotal in my career. He's really pushed me to speak publicly, which I often have struggled with. And this, it, for me, is a really good exercise to be able to do that and to build confidence, which I'm doing. So, yeah, I want to thank you for that. Would you mind answering a question for Jason?
Not at all. Go for it.
I just need to scroll back. As I said, Jason is a barricade and hostage negotiator. He's got his dream job. His question to you is, I work with the police as a crisis negotiator and mediator, and I'm very proud of the work I do alongside them. The team you led on Hunted contains psychologists and profilers. In your time as a serving officer, did you notice a move towards understanding criminals' behaviour through psychology, etc., and do you value it as a resource for fighting crime?
No, we didn't, Jason, right? Probably because, you know, I left the cops, what, 20 years ago, and the area of crime and policing that I was in was serious and organised crime, so we didn't. But what did happen at the time, excuse me, was that profiling, geographical profiling, psychological profiling, was coming into police work for murder investigations. And let me tell you a short story, if I may. Have we got time for this, Jack? Yep. Okay.
We've got all the time you want, mate.
Okay. One day, I was in the canteen at New Scotland Yard, and I met a mate of mine that I'd worked with at Kensington years ago, and he was on a homicide investigation into a dreadful killing of a young woman, mum, called Rachel Nickell, who was murdered on Wimbledon Common. And it was getting massive publicity, and a young man called Colin Stagg had been arrested for this crime but was not yet charged. The police, going on the advice of a geographical profiler, I think he was, had launched an undercover operation, a honey trap, and they sent a female undercover police officer to befriend Stagg and then have a series of meetings and conversations with him. And Stagg ended up getting charged on the strength of these conversations. Well, I saw this colleague of mine in the canteen at New Scotland Yard, and we went and had a cup of tea. And I went, go on in, mate. Go on, tell us all about the investigation. And he went, it's him. It's Colin Stagg. He said, it's him. Without a shadow of a doubt, it's Colin Stagg. We've got the right man. Oi! Right. Colin Stagg was charged, went on trial at the Old Bailey, and the case was slung out. And the judge was utterly scathing in his criticism of the undercover operation and the fact that Colin Stagg had been prosecuted. Sometime after that, the real murderer, a vile, repulsive man who was later convicted of other murders and rapes, called Robert Napper, was convicted of that crime because he was the true culprit. So I always have had some kind of, shall we say, caution about accepting those kind of what I would call soft sciences. They're imprecise sciences, aren't they? It's not splitting the atom. It's not developing a vaccine that will work or won't. It's in my opinion, you see, and for me, that is very, very dangerous, because I firmly believe that every investigation into a crime should be a search for the truth and not proof. You see, with Colin Stagg, they tried to prove a theory. So they were after proof and not truth. If they'd gone for the truth, they might have arrested Robert Napper earlier, and the list of victims that he claimed might not be as long as it tragically is.
Wow.
Great question, by the way, Jason. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a brilliant question. Have we got any more questions? Let me have a look. Josie Jane Brown, who is my PA and one of my closest friends, she just wanted to let you know that she really enjoys your narration on the crime shows. She says,
Thank you, Josie.
She says you're clearly good at what you do. And we need more people with your dedication and devotion to the job. Is it a different sort of kettle of fish now with coppers? Is it a different breed?
Yeah, I think policing has changed. Much of it for the good, by the way, unrecognisably from my day. And most of that is for the good, right? You know, still, those frontline men and women are heroes. End of story. Dedicated, yeah, there's wrong ones, but, you know, you take any organisation of 100,000 people and tell me there's not going to be wrong ones amongst them, right?
Mm.
By and large, I think the frontline are wonderful. I think, sadly, often they are lions being led by careerist donkeys. And that is a great concern to me. I think promotion in the police these days is so much about being able to use the right terminology, the right phrases and that kind of stuff, rather than being a natural leader of men and women. You know, it's gone 10 to 10 now, but don't get me started on that, because we will be here till the small hours. And I feel sometimes for the front line, but, you know, we shall see.
Yeah. I think probably we should maybe leave it there.
We can always have part two, can't we, sometime,
Jack? I would love a part two, mate. I would love a part two.
See what the feedback is. See if your audience fancy it. But, yeah, we can come back. There's many other things we can talk about. You know, old tales from undercover. If we do it in, you know, 2 or 3 months' time, there'll be more developments on the hunt for Kevin Pyle.
Yep.
Give it 4 or 5 months, perhaps, when I've travelled a bit more widely and all of that, and it'll be great to come back. And may I just say, thank you for having me, Jack.
Thank you for having me, mate. It's been an extreme pleasure. I apologise for all the technical difficulties we had. Shed X was meant to be House X tonight, I think. It certainly is warmer, I will admit that. Thanks everybody for sticking by.
Anybody who has stuck this out tonight through all those technical irritations and everything like that deserves a blooming medal. So thank you very much. It's been a privilege to be able to talk to you.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Peter. I will catch up with you in a little while for a debrief, let's say.
Jack, you've got to message me tomorrow morning just to make sure there's been no negative impact on your mental health about talking about Liam and Lucy, okay?
Of course, mate.
Yeah,
of course. No worries, mate. Okay, I will say thank you to everybody for coming, and I will say goodbye, and I shall see you on episode 4.
Cheers, buddy. Thanks, everyone.
Cheers, mate. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. What I will do is I will say thank you to Peter once again. Any book that's been mentioned, any pictures, any wanted posters, we will post on the Accidental Journalist site, and we will see what we can do to get it out there. Let's try and get Peter some books sold so he can carry on hunting for Kevin Pyle. I agree, he does need to be found. Please feel free to carry on with the messages on Facebook. I will pass them all on to Peter. Thank you, everybody, for getting involved. Thank you for all your questions. And thank you for your, thank you just for sticking around despite all the irritations of really bad feeds and things like that. We got there eventually. I will see you for episode 4 pretty soon. Episode 5. I apologize. Episode 5 pretty soon. We hope to just keep taking this up. Please keep sharing this. Do what you can to get this out to as many people as you can. Kevin Pyle must be found. Just keep sharing and do what you can. Thank you for all your support, and I will see you again next time. And with that, I will bid you good night. Thank you.